Welcome to the Spoolcast. Chris Risden joins Adam Churchill in this follow-up to his virtual seminar, Orchestrating Experiences, Strategy and Design for Complex Product Ecosystems. Chris didn't have time to answer all the questions during the seminar, so we decided to address those remaining questions in this podcast. If you didn't attend the seminar, don't worry, there's plenty here for you too. And now, here's Adam.
Hello, everyone. Happy New Year, and welcome to another episode of the Spoolcast. Recently, Chris Risden presented a fantastic virtual seminar for our audience. It's called Orchestrating Experience, Strategy and Design for Complex Product Ecosystems. Now, that recording, the recording of Chris's seminar, is available along with about 193 other UX seminars, and they're all now part of UIE's All You Can Learn. It's a subscription-based library that you can actually get your hands on all of those recordings when you need them. You know, project work, something comes up and you need to bump up on a skill, or you've got somebody that's on your team that needs to learn a new skill or how to do something a little differently. They're all there available for you when you need them. So check that out. On Chris's seminar, our design challenges are becoming more and more complex, right? Services are more interconnected across channels, both digital and physical. And more importantly, one of the things Chris talked about is across time and space. And in his seminar, he showed us how to make sense of all those moving parts of this increasingly complex system. And in today's podcast, we're going to talk a bit more about it and address some of the questions that our audience had. So, hey, Chris, thanks for coming back.
Hey, thanks for having me. Glad to be back.
So for some of the folks that weren't with us for your seminar, can you give an overview on what you presented that day?
Sure. And you started to set the table pretty well. Over the past 4 or 5 years, I had started to figure out, and a lot of us at Adaptive Path, what it looks like to sort of, I guess, the maturation of our process as we were dealing with more complicated design challenges. And you said it really well. We were doing something really good as digital product designers. We were bringing empathy and design thinking and an informed strategy around defining the user experience. And for us at Adaptive Path, and for me and the projects I was tackling, we were doing that, and organizations were sort of realizing, well, what you did in that group, like the .com group or the user experience group or the digital product group, why couldn't you do that for our call center? I mean, that process isn't necessarily a digital-centric process, or our physical space. And, you know, we've talked about, you know, how user experience, as we typically define it, an experience design isn't confined to digital. It doesn't have to be digital. If you go to talks and they talk about digital, and people will say, oh, it doesn't have to be digital, it's really a more universal process. The fact of the matter is, it's true, but 90% of what we do has still been digital. But that's really started to change. So we saw this. Organizations were asking us to sort of expand what we were doing out of the .com or the UX or the digital product group and apply it to other parts of the organization. And then we were still sort of at that ground up where we were individually applying it. And then we saw what they started asking us to do was to say, well, now we need all these parts to work together. So it's great that you've helped improve our call centers or improved our physical retail spaces or improved our digital products. But now we're realizing, you know, you hear omni-channel and cross-channel and service design, whatever the lens is, we know we need to kind of create this holistic experience. And so really what the virtual seminar I did was about was kind of not anything new from a process standpoint. It still talked about research. It still talked about synthesis and still talked about understanding the end users or the customers. It was just sort of what adjustments can you make or need to make, or what things can you bring in from other disciplines such as service design or a framework of customer experience that can help your design process tackle these more complicated systems. So the nutshell of what it's about is saying, well, what does it look like to tackle these complicated systems? But then also, now that we're having to deal with more moving parts and more complexity, how do we maintain empathy in the face of that increased complexity? So, you know, the virtual seminar really wanted to understand the main characteristics of these products and services or product ecosystems was that they were basically unfolding over time and through many different touch points or channels. And so the idea of the shifting context became really important. And so what does it look like if we have greater complexity? We want to maintain empathy with all these moving parts. And we want to understand, instead of thinking about designing static products, like if someone's going to use an interface when they sit at their desk at work or when they sit at their laptop, what's the approach for planning and designing these experiences when we factor in that they're going to unfold over time and space. So previously, I had talked about experience mapping. And experience mapping is a great sort of hub tool to get a handle on how your end user or your customer is experiencing your product or service over time. And the reason I call it a hub, and what this virtual seminar aimed to do, was to kind of expand the framework beyond just that core methodology. The basic approach isn't trying to reinvent how we go about doing our work, especially if you're within the field of user experience and you think about understanding your customers and understanding research. It's really understanding how we modify that approach to handle these more complicated design challenges that have more moving parts, more platforms or media, more channels involved, also more stakeholders involved from the organization, because you might be pulling from different areas like call centers and physical retail and operations. And so this is really a framework that looks to say, how do we modify what we do, or how do we bring in other processes and methodologies from different disciplines like customer experience or service design, and bring that together to see, okay, we have more complicated problems, we want to maintain empathy, what does our process look like as we evolve it to do this? And so one of the ways I think of it is the fact that I used to, and I still do, I still very much teach experience mapping as a methodology. And it's a great way to articulate insights you have about your end user, your customer. And so I often refer to that as the hub of empathy and understanding. If you think about it as a hub, an experience map as a hub, I call it a hub because you can move in two directions. You can move up. And what I say by up is you look at the journey and then you can understand, how do we want to do process engineering? How do we want to prioritize and do road mapping? How do we want to marshal our resources within our organization? You can kind of look at these big picture things that affect your organization or affect your strategy for moving forward. But as a hub, you can also move down and you take an individual moment from within the experience map and say, okay, how do we want to design this moment better, this touch point? For example, this conversation somebody's having when they call the customer service center, or the experience they're having when they use the mobile phone while they're in the retail store as well. And so we start with that, and I've taught that a lot, but I really think of orchestrating experiences and orchestrating touch points as the full framework. It talks about the research you need to do in order to get a handle on these complex experiences. It talks about not just the experience mapping, but the things you do after the experience mapping, like identifying opportunities, how you envision what the future state should look like, how you do some process engineering, or you want to support the new journey by doing service blueprinting. And then how do you design for moments, not just design for screens, but design for things that are going to probably be cross-channel in nature. That might be a screen that also interfaces with the phone or interfaces with the physical environment. So really, the virtual seminar is about the larger framework within experience mapping lives to think about these more complicated problems.
Awesome stuff, Chris. So let's talk about some of the questions that rolled in from our audience. Some of the folks were wondering, how do you sort of socialize the concepts of things like channels and touch points in your organization when those are terms, words, things to think about that you just haven't used before?
Yeah, I think in the case of channels, it's not that we haven't used them. I think it's that we've used them in different ways to mean different things depending on the context of our work environment. You know, if we're in marketing, we might mean one thing with channels. And if we're in the .com area, we might do other things with channels. You know, both might think of like email as a channel, but marketing is going to think about print as a channel. .com is going to wonder if live chat is a channel or mobile is a channel, even though all these things can live together. And then with regards to touch point comes from really retail and a little bit of service design, and it's not something that's used from a traditional user experience standpoint. And I kind of see that as a reclamation project because it's kind of been like discarded as confusing because you often get touch point and channel sort of conflated together. But really, touch points are about identifying a moment, like a specific human need in a specific time and place. When you interact with a brand or an organization or a product, whether that's calling somebody through the call center or whether that's getting on your mobile phone, what you're trying to do is deliver to meet a specific need for that person at that specific time and place. And that tells you a little bit about the context in which that's happening so you can understand how to design for that. And so both these things aren't necessarily new, but what we are doing is introducing them so that they feel like they complement each other. And when you introduce that into the organization, the best way to do it is through a couple of case studies where you can really illustrate. So this is what's happening. Here's a touch point. This is a moment where some persona like John is trying to get this done. And that's how we define the touch point. And then here are the channels that actually are involved in supporting that. They get on their mobile phone, they get on the website a little bit, they find something, and then there's a link that allows them to dial right up and call or something like that. These are the things that define what you can do to meet or to deliver on that moment or that touch point. And so really to introduce them, you're not necessarily introducing completely new concepts. I think you're more level setting so that everyone kind of has the same sense of definition of what those concepts mean.
Awesome. Say more about touch point. There seems like people are talking about user stories in Agile in their design process. Does it get confusing when now we're talking about touch points? Are they things that work together, or is there actually a conflict?
They don't have to be a conflict. A lot of that depends on context, but it's interesting that you bring that up because I often use what I'm trying to define, like, oh, this is what a touch point is. I use Agile user stories as an example because I said earlier that a touch point is really an interaction that involves a specific human need in a specific time and place, which kind of means that, you know, I might be Chris that needs to do X for the Y reason. And that's sort of the anatomy of a user story. I'm somebody who needs to do something for a certain reason. So I've tried to make sure people can kind of understand touch points by using that familiar analogy. But they can be different because touch points are usually looking at kind of a macro moment, meaning it might be a moment that's not limited to the screen. It might be something where I need to be on the computer, but then I need to get a text message to do some two-step security. So that's another channel involved. And then I need to get back onto the computer. User stories are typically going to be in a development environment and thinking about the screens and thinking about the features. So there's two ways to go about it. You might just need to start at the macro level and your cross-functional team, that's going to be more than just developers and designers, can think in terms of touch points. We have a moment here what we want to design for, and that's what that touch point is. And then you might graduate it to saying, okay, now that we're dealing with the specific screens, we might translate that into very specific user stories and epics that are another part of that environment. Or you call them whatever you want. If it's easier to essentially think about it, I'm not necessarily an advocate that you have to adopt the vocabulary of touch points. If you still largely work in a digital environment and you don't have the same cross-functional, I guess you could call it language barriers, where you kind of want to have everyone have a shared frame of reference, then call it a user story and think of it in those terms. So there's one way, or depending on the context of like whether you're starting at a very broad cross-functional group, and so a touch point and thinking about those moments that can be multi-channel in nature and thinking about those, and then later when you're dealing specifically with the screens, sort of translating to touch points, or if you're digital and just staying with user stories and just thinking about those specific needs at those specific points and times, either way can work depending on the organization.
In this process, how do you define the need for a digital versus a human touch point?
That's a good question. You know, I think, you know, a little bit is if you do your research and you look at your customer insights, what you'll see is when people are using which channels. Are they talking to a person over the phone? Are they talking to a person, say, in a store or at a front desk? Are they on a screen? You have remote agents, so you might be talking through a video channel on a phone headset. So it's both sort of like a digital channel while also being a human touch point. So the old way of thinking about touch points, the more branding and retail way, was thinking of touch points as three different things. You could have a static touch point, which would be like advertising or packaging. So these are things that you don't interact with, but are moments you come in contact with a brand or an organization or a product or service. And then you have interactive touch points, and that's very clearly like websites and kiosks. And you have human touch points, and that could be, you know, a call center, or it could be, you know, going to the Apple store and talking to a rep or a genius or something like that. I didn't think that that really told us much about what needed to be met and what context was happening by the fact that I was talking to somebody. Versus, I mean, if I call up a phone center and I want to transfer funds from one account to the other, or I call up and I want to close my account, those are very different touch points because those are very different needs that might be happening in very different times and places, or at least in very different contexts. And so I really didn't worry about defining touch points, whether they were a human touch point or a digital touch point. I might sit there and define that it's on a digital channel, like on a screen, or it's in a physical channel, like in the store, or it's on a phone channel. But the touch point itself is really about the human need of, like, I want to close my account or I want to transfer funds. And then I'll look at what I have at my disposal to support that. Is there a human element or is there a digital element? Is there a physical element? And I'll define it that way. So it's less about defining human touch points versus digital touch points and understanding the touch points around the human need. And then the channels are really what you have to support it. And those could be human, those could be digital, those could be physical.
Now, I know this is a tricky one, but how do you get user stories if you're building something that doesn't yet exist?
Okay, so user stories are defining touch points, defining specific moments when those moments don't exist. Well, what you really do then, what your journey should look like, what you're researching is the current state. And so what you want to do is research, you know, what life is like without it. And, you know, look at something like an Uber. What is the journey for people to get from point A to point B through the traditional cab system, whether they call somebody or whether they reserve it online or whatever it is. And so you have touch points that don't exist because those are touch points that Uber has, like interfacing with the screen and seeing where your driver is on a map or rating your driver at the end, or the absence of touch points. Like, I don't have to worry about paying my fare at the end of the ride. So what you're doing is you're going to start by looking at the current state journey, and you're going to then see what those gaps and those opportunities are where you can fill in a role. So you are sort of defining new touch points, but what you're going to do is identify either touch points that need to change or touch points that need to go away or touch points that need to exist that don't exist when you look at sort of the current state ecosystem. We're big fans of ecosystem mapping, which is the idea of really uncovering all the moving parts that influence your product or service, particularly when you're introducing something new. And that could be, you know, I'll use the Uber as an example. It's like, what are all the things we have to think of? Sure, we have to think of drivers and cars, but we also have to think of municipal regulations. We have to think of parking. We have to think of refueling. We have to think of all these things really exhaustively to understand how they influence our potentially new or innovative or disruptive service that doesn't exist yet. And that's going to reveal touch points that you didn't really even know existed, even when you were thinking about doing this. You have to kind of uncover them. So there is a point of, like, looking at the current state of the ecosystem, uncovering really what the touch points are, and then understanding how those change when you want to introduce your new ecosystem. It's almost metaphorically like an overlay. You have a current state and you're overlaying a new state. So you're going to be looking at, okay, these touch points match. In the new system and in the old system, this touch point still is going to exist. People are going to still have to call somebody up or something like that. Okay, here's a touch point that goes away. I don't have to pay for my cab fare at the end of the ride. Here's a touch point that needs to exist. I have to enter my card to be a part of the service before I get started. And so you kind of overlay where things are duplicated, where they're going to change, and where they either go away or are introduced as new.
Any experience or thoughts to offer when teams are representing non-linear experiences?
Sure. If we think about an ecosystem map, which is one of the early kind of discovery activities that we often recommend, where we, like I said, unsurface all the moving parts, those are very non-linear in nature. We just care about uncovering something. So, for example, in a workshop, one of our case studies is a car dealership and rethinking how car dealerships need to evolve. So kind of to your previous question, you know, what does it look like, a new service that would be on top of this? And so we have to uncover everything from the lot and salespeople to third-party things like insurance and financing and all these things that involve the cars themselves, test drives. And when we do that, we don't care about the linear nature of it at this time. We just care about uncovering it. So that's one thing that's a good place to start when you already know that you might be thinking of a sort of a nonlinear process. The second thing is when you do experience maps or customer journey mapping, we care about time because it's linear in the sense that time is always moving forward. So if it's nonlinear in the sense that you have to go back and do something or you might do multiple things over and over again. One common example is research. Like, let's say I want to go on a trip. I'm going to research for 1 week. I'm going to research for 3 weeks. I'm going to go back to blogs. I'm going to go back to Facebook recommendations or whatever it is. That's, in a sense, nonlinear. But in a way, it's still always going to be linear because it occurs over time. So time is the linear aspect of, say, a customer journey map or an experience map. But it doesn't mean that visually you don't tell the story by showing certain things repeat themselves or people go back in processes or people hit dead ends and then they need to fork into another path. So there's sort of that creativity of saying, you know, that this isn't necessarily have to be represented as a point A to point B to point C type of journey. It can be a journey that is generalizing all the things that may occur in time. And it definitely, you know, you can have things that one person wouldn't do, but you might represent both, like, I'm going to call customer service and I'm also going to talk on live chat. Your journeys that you have may not say, like, people do both, but you might represent both in an experience map to show that they both could occur. So the linear nature, I talk about being linear, but I think it's a good point because it isn't to imply that things have to happen in a sequential order. Things can happen in any order and be redundant and duplicative, but the linear part comes from the fact that they do occur over time in that sense.
Chris, we had some questions. There's obviously some teams that are thinking about, how do I take this idea that Chris is sharing and put it in our existing process? So one was about time, right? So how long would this end-to-end process with multiple stakeholders involved take to map and get agreement, come to a consensus on it?
Sure. There's the proverbial, it depends, as far as the qualifier that I know, I'm sure in every interview you get, and you talk to UX people, they always say those about five times an interview. But to give some examples, if you're just pulling out, say, the experience map, like I said, that's kind of a nice hub because people can kind of rally around that. It's a good excuse to get a cross-functional group in the room, you know, IT, marketing, UX, if they exist, you know, the call center or the physical operations or talent, people that are hiring, you know, the staff, things like that. So that's one of the reasons I refer to it as sort of a hub, because it's this good starting point. And that can be something that can take anywhere from 3 to 6 weeks, and sometimes from really complicated stuff, maybe up to 8. But you really are talking less than a month and a half, really, to do the research and get the inputs you need for those experience maps, which is really articulating insight, and then make some sense of that and use that in some way. And that's not too big of a lift for most organizations if they buy into the idea of that cross-functional collaboration of getting kind of what you could call this holistic insight to how those product ecosystems or those services are being experienced across touch points and across channels, and not just the screens or not just the call centers. But if you really look at the whole process, which can include a certain amount of research, it includes, you know, really exploring what the ecosystem is, what all those moving parts is, collaboratively getting those insights together through an experience map, how you then identify the opportunities or the pain points and really prioritize those and roadmap those as far as what you're seeing in those insights, envisioning what the future state could look like. Okay, we want to affect these moments or these touch points along the journey. We want to improve them. We want to redesign them. What does the new journey look like that can be sort of our North Star? Do service blueprinting, which is a way to really show, like, what are the people and the processes and the technology we need to support our future? And then actually going in and designing those touch points. That's hard to put a marker down because these usually become extended programs. And if this is done well, that's actually a good thing. It's like, okay, the feedback of prioritizing and roadmapping, you might create a 6-month roadmap or you might create a 2-year roadmap. But if you start with the idea of identifying and prioritizing what you should do, so the research, the experience map that articulates those insights from the research, and identify what that experience map is telling you that you might want to change or improve on, that can probably be anywhere from a 5 to an 8 week process. And then obviously what the lift is to actually make those improvements, roadmap them, understand what order, what you need to do to actually have them. It goes in a cyclical, iterative cycle, just like a lot of things do. That's going to vary completely depending on the context of whether you're a small company and pretty much just a digital ecosystem, or you're a ginormous financial services institution or healthcare institution that's going to have a lot of moving parts to align in and get in place.
So how about quantifying it? How many maps does a company need? This particular team was asking, how many maps does a company have to have with different experiences? And then do you split those up by the different personas the design teams are working with?
Yeah, there's no set number. I mean, you don't want too many just because you start to lose a real sense of focus because there's just going to be more than you're going to be able to address. But it's good to recognize that, you know, what I'm not advocating, I don't think anyone at Adaptive Passive are advocating, is like, you don't need a map. Sometimes you might start with a map, and then sometimes you might need 2 or 3 maps. And it's going to be dependent on context of, like, do you need to separate, say, the journey of the customer from the journey of the employee? Those could be separate maps. Or you have very distinct personas that go on very divergent paths or are using a separate sort of product or service from each other. So you might have 2 or 3 maps there, and you might even have 4. you know, once you get to, if you have so many personas that you have like 6 or 7 or 8 maps, then what I would do is I'd find ways to consolidate it. Like, well, these two personas have enough in common that they could be represented with one map, because once you're trying to produce that many maps, they sort of lose their effectiveness, that ability to say, we can put these on a wall, we can look and get a shared sense of what the insights are, and we can pull the same things out of them and kind of get a plan of action for addressing them. But we've often done somewhere between 2 and 4 maps, depending on the context. And it can be maps based on breaking up the stages. Like, well, here's the onboarding process, and that's a separate map because it's complicated enough. Here's the service delivery part of it, and that's a separate map. So it could be about chunking up the journey to make sense and be communicated in different ways. It could be about divvying it up by persona or by some sort of use case. And then sometimes we like to actually overlay them. If it's really, you know, where the personas go on the same journey, essentially, they interact with the same touch points, and their perceptions of them, whether they're like a business customer or a consumer customer, are different, then it could be interesting to overlay those journeys on the same map. So it's really going to depend on the context of what you're trying to get out of it. And the best lens to start that thinking is probably to understand, well, why do we want an experience map? Why do we want to do this? And there's really 3 things you should look at. You might really care about one of these things, or you might care about all 3 of them. But one is the organizationally. Like, what we have to understand is, where do we need to marshal our resources? Do we need more people here? Do we need less people here? How do we need to transform our organization to make it sustainable? How do we lower some silos so we're communicating better? And so, are we doing this map for organizational purposes? Is it strategic purposes? Like, we need to identify where the problems are or where some unmet opportunity is, and roadmap them and service blueprint them so that we can actually, you know, implement the changes that we're seeing on the map. Or is it sort of design guidance? Like, we want to take certain moments of the journey and say, like, what is it that we should understand about this when we sort of improve it or redesign it? Is it that it should, you know, meet certain design principles or meet certain metrics? And so, organizational, strategic, or kind of design tactical, you'll look at those, and a lot of those things are going to help you determine, like, how many maps you need and split in which different ways.
What about, can you talk a bit about blueprints? Question came in, can the re-engineering of the journey be a valid stage in getting to a service blueprint?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting question. I'm not totally sure what it means if you are re-engineering the journey, or are you using the journey as a step to the blueprinting. It's definitely the latter. We see blueprinting being a great activity to come after the journey. So a lot of people ask about future state experience maps, and you can do future state experience maps, but I personally have not been a big fan of them. I found that there's qualitatively better ways to represent the future, because when you have an experience map, you're showing how your product or service is being experienced. And obviously you're going to have, you know, highs and lows. I really liked how that conversation went with the call center. I really hated how I couldn't recover my password on the screen. And so your future state is where everything's going to be great and everything's going to be high when you look at kind of the data visualization of an experience map. So that's one reason I'm not a big fan of future state experience maps. I think, you know, whether you do prototypes or whether you do storyboards, I think there's better ways to visualize how you want your future design to be experienced and how you intend it. Like, if we do this, this is what the journey will look like. And that journey could be a 5-panel sketched storyboard, or it could be a set of screens, or whatever it needs to be. So where I think, you know, if you really look at the journey level of the future state, I think service blueprinting is where you really want to think about the future state. Service blueprinting typically can look like a process flow diagram, but it doesn't have to be contained in that. But why I say that is because you can think of it metaphorically as a bunch of boxes you can move around. So you can say, like, if we change this one interaction point, and you might want to blueprint what's involved in that interaction, like what people are involved, what technology is involved, what processes happen, like, you know, someone fills out an application, then a person in the back reviews that application, and then they enter it into a database. All these things go along to support that interaction. That's where I think you really care about looking at the future state, and you can almost use service blueprinting as kind of a prototyping tool when you're prototyping processes and flows. And so it is good for process reengineering to think about the future state through the lens of a service blueprint instead of the lens of an experience map.
There's a question that came in about sort of a challenge with clients. Have you ever run into a situation where they've wanted to take the research findings and sort of run with them before the recommendations have sort of been created in a sort of a more of a team environment.
Yeah, and I think this is a problem that could be persistent outside of this orchestrating experiences or experience mapping kind of framework, is people want to look at the data that hasn't been synthesized yet. We haven't found connections and patterns and themes across inputs, across voice of customer, across web analytics, across usability studies, across just even customer interviews for how they perceived their experience or their journey, so to speak. I had a colleague, Todd Wilkins, used to have what we called Wilkins' Law, which was that the value of research is inversely proportional to the size of the binders contained in, which is a fancy way of saying that a lot of stakeholders, a lot of executive stakeholders, think that they're paying, whether it's internal and they're paying through resource allocation or it's external, think they're paying for a giant binder with lots of data points, when really what's more valuable is a thin binder full with really crisp insights. And in many ways, that's what we try to get through with an experience map, is what you have. An experience map is usually accompanied by like a proper research report. But from a socializable way of getting insights across, it's one document. It can be a dense document. It can be a dense, we make these large, we make them, you know, 4 feet by 3 feet, so you can put them on a wall and actually use them in workshops and use them as tools. They can be dense, but they're also very concise because they're the insights and not simply the data points. And so we hope that that one reason you can use an experience map is you can use it as a tool to sort of bypass the idea that some executives are going to say, like, just give me that thick binder full of data points. And you're hoping to have, like, oh, how can I make this something that's more valuable by being more concise and not ironically thinner, so to speak, metaphorically thinner, by not being 1,000 data points and instead being a dozen key insights. And so you hope that people buy into the process, that they don't sort of co-opt the research data, that they're along for the ride and buy into the process, because hopefully they're involved, that they'll get to the more crisp and concise research insights.
Great stuff, Chris. Thanks for giving us some more of your valuable time.
You bet. Very appreciative of you having me again.
Anytime, anytime. To our audience, remember that you can get at Chris's virtual seminar and over 190 other awesome UX presentations at All You Can Learn. Thanks for your support of the virtual seminar program, and goodbye for now.
You can access the recordings of all of our past virtual seminars as part of UIE's All You Can Learn. For more information, visit aycl.uie.com. That's aycl.uie.com. As always, thanks for listening.